All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest is Michael Hastings. He's contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine, author of the article, The Runaway General, that cost Stanley McChrystal his job, and also author of the book, I Lost My Love in Baghdad, A Modern War Story. Welcome back to the show, Michael. How are you doing, man?
Good, Scott. Thanks for having me. Happy holidays.
Yeah, you too. I'm glad to have you back here. It's been a little while since we talked. So I think everybody listens to this show anyway knows that there was an election in Iraq last March. And
right.
The winners didn't win and the losers haven't conceded and nobody seems to be able to form a coalition. And yet there's always announcements that we've made a breakthrough and we're going to form a government now. And then I'm not sure, you know, exactly where it stands right now. I was wondering if you could help provide some insight as to what the hell's going on over there.
Well, you're right. The political leader who got the most votes is not going to be the leader of the country. That would be Ayatollahi, where Prime Minister Maliki, who has been running Iraq for the last few years, it looks like he's going to maintain control of the country. And it seems, I just got a press release from the U.S. Embassy saying that the government had been formed. So it seems that, you know, after 9 months, which I believe is one of the longest government formation processes in history of any country, the government in Iraq is finally formed. And not surprisingly, as I had predicted at the time and what others have also said, it essentially solidifies a Shiite-dominated Iraqi government that looks like it's going to be in control for years to come, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I wonder, they say that Iyad Alawi and his group, that even though he's a Shia, he's really a secular Ba'athist kind of guy and has the support of the Sunnis. But I wonder, to what degree could this former Saddam, former CIA agent, former puppet prime minister of the country, who, after all, helped start the civil war against the Sunnis back a few years ago, I guess 5 years ago now. How could it be that he's all the political representation they have? And is it really true that up there in the Anbar province that they consider him to be their representative of any kind? They vote for him?
They would vote for him, and what it actually indicates just how bad things got in Iraq between, 05 and 08, essentially. There's this great, I think this is a true story, when a journalist friend of mine asked an Anbari resident this question. So how could you, vote for Alawi after what he did to Fallujah and Ramadi? And the answer was, well, he did it in Najaf as well, which was a Shiite city.
Jesus.
So he was, you know, equal in his sort of brutal treatment of both sects. But the reality is, from what I saw, you know, I spent a lot of time there this past year, as well as when I was there for Newsweek years ago. And if you're not a Shiite, if you're not part of the Maliki sort of team, you're not going to have much political power. That's just it, you know, and in fact, what Maliki has done by sort of seizing control of the security forces, the police, as well as the army, as well as a lot of government ministries, is to essentially squeeze out any and all political opposition, of which Alawi, as you said, it's kind of, you know, here's a guy who was a U.S. puppet, CIA agent, and he becomes like, you know, the best hope, you know, for moderate Iraqis. It just shows how off the rails the whole thing had really gone.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so Abdulaziz al-Hakim, who was the patriarch, I guess, of the Hakim clan, which controlled the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, he's died. And
yeah.
I guess they say his son is sort of an ineffectual type and doesn't have nearly the clout that his father had. And I was just wondering, and the Iraqi National Alliance as it used to be and the different pieces as it's broken up on the Shiite power side there, I guess, underneath Maliki on the flow chart there. Can you describe the relative power as it exists now, per your best understanding, between the Supreme Islamic Council types, the Hakim clan, Muqtada al-Sadr, and those loyal to him, and for that matter, the Fadil militia down there in Basra and whoever else on the Shiite side?
Sure. I think the way that I understand it, and probably the most accessible way to understand it, is that both Maliki and Sadr even represent a sort of Iraqi nationalist strain of the sort of Shiite Islam, while the Skiri guys, Abdulaziz al-Hakim, are viewed with great suspicion by a lot of Iraqis because of their close ties to Iran. So the Badr Brigade, Skiri, Aziz's son, they are going to have their sort of 20% following, just because they have still great influence within the security services, and they were able to really, grab a foothold in government, but they're not popular. They're not politically popular on the street, so to speak, where both Maliki, surprisingly, as well as Sadr have much greater sort of popularity and credibility even among Iraqis. You'll find Iraqis, when you do just sort of voice, man on the street interviews, who will say, why they like Maliki, and why they like Sadr, but it's really rare to find anyone who likes Hakim, because of this view that Skiri is Iranian influenced. A lot of the Skiri guys actually fought against Iraq in the 80s during the Iran-Iraq War. So it's, there's history there.
Yeah, and I guess, now, Maliki's a Dawa Party guy, but I'm trying to remember if it was Juan Cole or somebody taught me years ago, I think, that the Dawa Party was basically split in half during the Iran-Iraq War years, and that where Jafari, the first Dawa Party prime minister, had been in Iran, like the Skiri guys, Maliki had not, that he was in Europe, I guess, at the time, in exile. And so I guess somehow is viewed less suspect that way. But I guess he's been the prime minister for quite a few years now. So
yeah, exactly.
I guess, though, I'm interested in the way you say that he's seen as really a more nationalist figure like Muqtada al-Sadr, rather than very pro-Iranian. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? Because that's usually he's, I would think, lumped in with the more pro-Iranian factions there. After all, it was Iranian Revolutionary Guard intervention that got him the job in the first place.
Sure. No, I think it's one of these tricky questions. The question, how in the pocket of Iran is Maliki? And this also goes back to the early 80s, where Maliki himself, after being kicked out of Iraq, he had to leave Iraq because he was a member of the Dawa Party, which was banned, actually was in exile in Iran for a couple of years, where he was involved in political activities. Now, the Iranians kicked him out of Iran, which is kind of interesting. And people say, his friends say, he's never forgiven them for kicking him out of the country, because his wife was pregnant at the time and basically sent him over to Syria, and it was a very difficult time in his life. Now, so you have this sort of personal baggage he has against Iran. My take on Maliki is he's going to play Iran. Iran is clearly more of a natural ally to him than the United States, but he's going to play both the United States and Iran for what he thinks are his best interests. And clearly his relations with Iran is really, really tricky. I spoke to one of his close friends last time I was there, and he said to me, this story never ran, but it was a really interesting quote. And what he said was that Maliki had told him, he said, if I die, it's going to be because Iran killed me. So literally, Maliki was fearing for his life that the Iranians were actually going to take him out. But essentially, I would say that he is closer to Iran than to the Saudis. He certainly hates the Saudis. And he's going to use Iran when it suits him, and Iran's going to use him. But I think it's a little bit of an oversimplification to say he's in Iran's pocket. Though you'll hear a lot of people in the States say that, especially, neocon types, because they want to continue to push a kind of everlasting, enduring presence in Iraq, which is, this is the next big step, right?
Right, and yet somehow they don't have to take responsibility for being behind a war that installed the Iranians in power there. They just only want to complain about Iranian influence in Iraq, but never mind the day before yesterday or how it got to be that way. But now, hold on 1 second, because we can talk more about that in a minute, but or you can say whatever you want, but I want to ask you this before I forget. This has been 5 years ago now, so maybe everything's different, but it was after both battles of Najaf, though it was before the, you know, the big war of 2007 against the Sadrists. But Muqtada al-Sadr, 5 years ago, December 2005, said, look, let's have a government of national salvation. It'll be me and one of these minor Kurdish factions and the Sunnis together, nationalist Iraqis first, and forget all this sectarianism and whatever. And now it seems like that's not his way. He doesn't seem to have tried to pursue very, very hard at all the coalition with Alawi. So that would seem to me to define Muqtada al-Sadr's so-called nationalism nowadays as pretty much the same as Maliki's, which is pretty much in favor of Iran. It really is ultimately what the Supreme Islamic Council always wanted, which was Baghdad to Basra, a new Shia stand in alliance with Iran and nominally in control of the rest of Iraq, but not really. And it seems like if Sadr was really the nationalist, at least that he used to be, that he would have been pushing as hard as he could for an alliance with the Sunnis and say, you know, we're Iraqis first, America out, and all that, like he was doing 5 years ago. Whatever happened to that? And not that I like Muqtada al-Sadr, but, you know, his power seems to me the best hope of America being forced to get out of that country, and I want that.
Right. Well, I think, I mean, what happened, I think, is the civil war happened. Sadr got marginalized. I mean, Maliki did go after him in a pretty significant way. And, you know, Muqtada ended up in Iran himself. I believe he's still there, under kind of Iranian protection. So I think, you know, the Sadrists, in fact, didn't want to support Maliki and eventually came around to it. It's a Shiite nationalism for sure. And as you said, I mean, definitely, you know, pro-Iran, but certainly there's a spectrum from the Skiri guys to the Sadrists, at least how they're perceived in terms of their nationalist tendencies. But yeah, I mean, the idea of some sort of unity government, I think, is basically a fiction, and, the political lines have been drawn down sectarian lines, for the most part. You know, there's token kind of, you know, unity government stuff going on, but I think that's going by the wayside.
Yeah, well, here's my worry, that the Sunni and Shia power among the Arabs in Iraq will paper over their differences and begin to get along against their new enemy, the Kurds, who are trying to take Kirkuk and the oil land there, and that doesn't seem like a problem that's going to be worked out in this parliament or another one either. That's going to be worked out on the battlefield right there.
It's certainly possible. I mean, I remember interviewing the Kurdish defense minister up in Erbil a couple of years ago, and he had a map of Kurdistan, independent Kurdistan, on his wall. When is that? You know, that's been out of boil for a while, and the question is, you know, is it going to, as you said, you know, get settled on the battlefield, or is it going to sort of stagger on as it is, trading shots here and there? And I think that's certainly a concern. I know it was a concern of the U.S. military, for a reason why they want to keep American soldiers in Iraq is to sort of, do some peacekeeping is the wrong word, but it's to be around that fault line to try to contain some of the damage. But certainly, you know, Maliki has no real love for the Kurds. You know, a lot of the Sunnis have no love for the Kurds, and the Kurds feel the same way about them. So, that's definitely another fault line. And you're probably right, as likely to end up in a battle as any sort of larger Sunni-Shiite fight in the region. Mm-hmm. Assuming we don't bomb Iran, but then that changes the whole equation.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of 2002 and all the reasons I said not to do this in the first place, but nobody could hear me because I was going out at 100 watts and nobody was listening.
Well, it's definitely amazing, you know, still talking about Iraq the most troubling thing to me about Iraq is, in fact, the sort of national amnesia that we have as a country, basically just trying to forget it. And then when we do remember it, it's now being remembered as a sort of success. And in fact, that's the blueprint we're using for our, you know, current quote unquote success in Afghanistan, is what we learned in Iraq. That to me is the most disturbing element of it all from a U.S. perspective.
Yeah. Well, and the most disturbing thing about that part of it to me is that all it took was a three-word slogan. It's like they used to put protecting the homeland over and over again on the background when George Bush would give a speech. Since he couldn't say anything coherent, at least people will read over and over and over again while he's talking, protecting the homeland, protecting the homeland, protecting the homeland. And it worked. And in this case, they said, the surge is working. The surge is working. The surge is working. A million billion times. And then the surge worked. The surge worked. Even Barack Obama has to admit the surge worked. And nobody ever explained what that meant at all. And the American people bought it completely.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, I'm working on a story. I spent most of this last month in Afghanistan, you know, basically working on, you know, talking, you're discussing these kinds of themes, right? Because you're seeing the same thing now with Afghanistan. You know, what does this review that just happened say? It says it's working, right? All we're going to hear is that it's working, it's working, it's working. And that's going to be the narrative, you know, and it's very, because people, that's what people want to believe. I mean, it's really incredible that it doesn't actually matter what the facts on the ground are, so to speak. It's just everybody, there's no, you know, the political incentive is just to sort of pretend that it's working.
So you're just back from Afghanistan, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I just got back this weekend.
Yeah, geez. Hey, man, can I call you back at 2:30 and we'll do an Afghanistan interview?
Yeah, sure, that'd be great.
Okay, killer. I'll talk to you then.
Cool, see you.
All right, thanks. Everybody, that's Michael Hastings. He's contributing editor at Rolling Stone Magazine. This is Anti-War Radio.